Next, in this stellar afternoon, we have Professor Conor Gaiety, who I am delighted to introduce as our final contributor. Yes, who's going to bring some spark to the afternoon, no doubt. Professor of Human Rights Law at the London School of Economics. Always controversial, always somebody to kick you out of any sense of complacency you may have fallen into, provoke you into re-examining some of your assumptions. And if I remind myself of his topic for this afternoon, I suspect that's exactly what he's going to do. Whether he speaks to it or not is another matter, but as I understand it, he's going to address us about judicial review, human rights, and the peril of knowing too much.
That's right, sir. Thank you very much. Thank you. I think it's very tempting, having listened to Anthony, and then be told I need to spark it up. I'm sorry, Anthony. I thought it was very sparky. Especially the bit where you talked about the seven, was it millionaires or QCs? QCs.
Cheap.
Which,
really cheap.
The first cheap remark. And the average age of 63, but there you are. I did a consultation input suggesting that they stop on the basis that there's no members of any ethnic community, there's no members of the disabled or differently abled, and that they are just a Lib Dem Tory deal to put off the terrible day when they confront this issue with Helena Kennedy. So I had hoped you'd all commit a kind of collective suicide, but you're battling on, and you've got some enthusiastic eye who's not a QC, who seems to consult with himself. When you issue consultation documents, this guy provides a reply to himself, which I thought was very entertaining, and that was the other subject of my own response to the consultation. Are people who are not on the commission allowed input, or is it just themselves? Anyway, there you are. I'm supposed to have you out of here by 5 o'clock, and I did offer. I must warn you, the boss has said carry on, but I won't. I'll get you out of here. You've got trains, you've got anxieties. You don't know how to get out of Exchange Square. I don't know how to get into Exchange Square. I went through 5 skyscrapers before I finally found the right one. I did offer to write a paper. I did, sort of, but you will have noticed there is no paper. There are just a series, and I didn't expect this, a series of rather revealing and embarrassing dots. If you don't produce a paper, normally you hope that it's quietly and obscurely forgotten, but they've gone to a great deal of trouble to show you that I've not produced a paper. And I think that will have CPD implications. I think this may be a less impactful day than you thought, and you may not get those 6 CPD points, so make sure you sign with a little asterisk, despite me. What I am going to talk about, this is why there is no paper, because I wanted to evoke in lack of preparation what I intended to discuss, which is the really interesting challenge of stuff. And the word stuff reminds us of that famous remark by, I thought, an underestimated accidental intellectual, Donald Rumsfeld, who used, of course, the word stuff as in stuff happens. An accidental intellectual because I don't think any of it is the result of the kind of cogitation that propelled him to the top of the wrestling world before he went into politics. But he also, I thought, because we all assumed he mainly talked garbage, we were too quick to discount his thoughtful intervention about the nature of knowledge, his epistemological intervention. And I want that to be the kind of centerpiece of my talk. And I want to talk about the dangers of knowing. The dangers of knowing. And I'm going to build it around Secretary of State and ex-Wrestler Rumsfeld's famous remarks, and then end with a new kind of unknowing, and then stop. And maybe there'll be questions. I'm a bit anxious about the old question thing, because I've obviously, like you, paid Tom, but I'm not sure there'll be anybody else. So, rather more in my case, I have to say. I'm not going to talk about the dangers of the sorts of things we read about China. I want to put it in slight context. There's a fascinating and terrifying article in Prospect this month, which I commend to you, by Isabel Hilton. The Chinese are celebrating in 2011 not the 100th anniversary of the end of empire and the arrival of democracy in 1911, which nobody knows about, but the 90th birthday of the Communist Party. The Chinese call the 27 million dead in the Great Leap Forward in the 1950s as a natural disaster. The Chinese didn't reveal for 30 years that 150,000 people had been killed in a disastrous dam, Henan Dam collapse in 1975. And if you look at the records in the relevant museum for Tiananmen Square in 1989, you find celebrations of the revolution and the visit, bizarrely, of President Bush. And that's it. So we want to be very careful before we go too quickly into any kind of glib assumptions about the unknown being better than the known. And we have experience in this country too of the, in the past, of the terrible, terrible tragedy of the unknown unknowns. And I think we need to acknowledge that a large percentage of the population in the world today has absolutely no understanding of its own past and no awareness of the extent to which the country was damaged by the actions of the governing elite. And it's extraordinary that this is possible still today. And it was a knowledge of the damage that that can do that led, I think, President Gorbachev to lead on such reforms in the Soviet Union. Because do you remember Chernobyl and his extraordinary understanding of how damaging it was that a regime would try and cover up stuff on that scale from its own people and from others? We've got, I hope here, not similar problems with unknown unknowns. And so I want to contextualise. We have, however, my first of two emendations of Rumsfeld. We have forgotten knowns. And the most remarkable forgotten known just recently, and it's also the case that there are many knowns we should not forget, was the discovery that the British forces in Iraq had forgotten that there was a ban on sensory deprivation, had forgotten the memorandum that had been circulated as a result of the Prime Minister's concession in 1975 that such activity should be prohibited. And that broadly is why it went on. And this is something just to pause and note, because for many years I've been celebrating Ireland versus the United Kingdom as evidence of a fantastic human rights achievement. And I've also pointed out that the British government had made the decision to end such practices in advance of that decision, as a result both of journalistic investigation and civil proceedings within the jurisdiction, on top of the inter-party proceedings in Strasbourg. But actually, for us here, does any of that matter? Do we exist in a little world where we are only interested in the arguments and not in the outcomes? How many of us ask questions about the impact of cases? And therefore, are there knowns we'd prefer to forget as a culture and knowns that as lawyers we choose not to remind ourselves of? You know, maybe sometimes we lawyers think the case is all. So those are caveats. Those are caveats. There are certainly things we need to know and not forget, and we must never be in a culture where we are unaware of what we do not know. A culture of totalitarianism and a culture of Big Brother. That said, and this is the thrust of my remarks really, I want to reflect with you on what it's like to live in a world where we can know so much and how challenging that is. It's, for example, been very challenging for a man I've never met, Dr. Liam Fox. It's been really tricky, hasn't it? He's been, Adam Verity, if that's his name, has been at no meetings. And then out comes a little YouTube excerpt of Mr. Verity at a meeting. It's extremely difficult now to avoid having to apologise for the misjudgment and giving the impression that you might possibly have misled anybody about anything. This, for politicians, must be quite tricky. You're a Google click away from exposure. But for lawyers, and I'm talking now not only about academics, but also about barristers. I think it's produced a real challenge for us. There was a decision yesterday, a big Supreme Court decision, AXA Insurance, really interesting case, a challenge to a Scottish legislation. And parenthetically, I think the challenge posed by Scotland to the United Kingdom Supreme Court is really remarkable and is becoming more severe, I think. But in the old days, we wouldn't have known about that case. And if we knew about it, it would have been through a short Times report. And there would then have been, over time, an appearance in an All England Law Report. And it would have slowly got out. Well, we have this 70 pages yesterday. And the combination of the British and Irish Legal Information Institute, that information, that fantastic organisation, and the neutral citation system has transformed the way in which we receive our information. I think that's a challenge for us all. I think as a teacher, let me tell you, before I mention the bar and then move on, as a teacher, I think it's a real challenge. When I first started teaching, you were the provider of otherwise inaccessible information. That was your thing as a lawyer. You brought along the cases in a photocopied format, which were the cases which otherwise these people could not access. And actually, that was the job in a way. And then, you know, if you had to fill the 2 hours, you synopsized them at great and boring length. And then you wrote them up in an unread book as a result of the failure of it being read, proof of its scholarship. You got promoted. Now, you know, it's really hard to work out what to do because the real challenge is to give students the information which allows a discussion, which means heavy censoring. So actually, the job of a teacher now is to work out what should not be known and to understand that the peril of knowing too much is to understand too little. And I think there's a little bit of that in the courts as well, though they've given me a big write-up here as a barrister, which I've enjoyed reading, but I'm mainly an academic, but I have been in court now and again. And I remember in particular, one case in which I was participating where learned counsel, not involving Anthony, were engaged in a deep analysis of a two-page commission decision on admissibility, which was available only in French. And it was a kind of macho show about who would put best use to their second home in Provence, you know? Was it necessary? It was driven by the logic of our system, which every now and again the judges try and curtail, but that logic reasserts itself. Stephen Sedley is very interesting on that, on the dynamic of the electronic shortcuts and when it has spread to judgments, as it now has, the seduction of cut and paste. Whilst there is an awful lot of stuff in there, I'd wager that many of us think that in knowing so much, we've learned rather less. Now, as regards not so much unknown unknowns, but as regards known unknowns, Anthony made a reference to this. It's clear that the successful operation of what is a right to privacy, a right to confidential information, is an operation of the Rumsfeldian principle of the deployment of a principle of known unknowns. There are things we know we don't know, and the courts are determined that we should not know them. And this has been important because I believe it needs strongly to be defended against extraordinarily powerful commercial interests that seek to shred the right to privacy in the name, in my opinion, wholly spuriously, of a right to freedom of expression. On the whole, I have no argument whatsoever with balancing privacy and expression. I am a tremendous supporter of the way in which the courts in this country have developed a very sophisticated jurisprudence on that. I am extremely suspicious of the commercial motivations behind the attacks on it from the press. Yeah. an obvious example is the way in which it is always completely ignored that it is the privacy of the children or of other innocent parties that is being protected as much as it is the privacy of the so-called ne'er-do-well character who plays football or appears on The X Factor or whatever it is. That's just completely ignored. And we need to remind ourselves of the extent to which there was extraordinary intrusion into people's private lives before the Human Rights Act in the name of a right to know, which was in fact bogus. It is a commercial interest in the selling of newspapers. If anybody is interested in it, have a look at Dacre's soapbox pulpit, to mix my metaphors, speech to the Leveson Inquiry yesterday. The editor of the Daily Mail, looking as though he's at one of his editorial committee meetings, holding forth without any accountability as usual, and I presume not appearing on television to be cross-examined by anybody afterwards. Paul Dacre, the editor of the Daily Mail in particular, has made a series of ad hominem attacks on judges, and I think the legal profession should stand up to him. It's interesting about the Human Rights Act, because perhaps the most counterproductive section is Section 12, where, as a result of Lord Wakeham's effort to exempt the press from the Human Rights Bill, as it then was, they having become aware rather late in the day that there was a right to privacy as well as a right to freedom of expression, and therefore having diluted their hitherto untrammelled enthusiasm for the measure, the government of the day, as a concession, introduced a clause, which became Section 12, which specifically acknowledges the importance of freedom of speech in cases involving ex-party applications, etc., which became, as it were, the evidence for the argument that the press were bound by the Human Rights Act in Douglas and Hello magazine. So it had the sort of opposite effect than was desired. So privacy law is part of an acknowledgement of the perils of knowing too much. What about a new category? Have all of these waters been drunk by various people who are potentially extremely ill?
I think so. We can get you a glass over there.
I would trust both people on the platform and yourself, but you'd never know who comes to a conference.
No.
One of you may have nipped up at a break and knocked it back. Thank you very much. Three examples of what I call unknown knowns. And they all involve students indirectly. One student of mine, the case is reported, so I'm sure he won't mind that being acknowledged, Boodoo and the BBC. 2010 EWHC 616. Sam Boodoo was a high-level guy working in some kind of human resources area, and he was the subject of negative web reports on the BBC in his local area, which were extremely damaging, and which reports were afterwards acknowledged by the police to be based on untruths, based on mistakes. He says, every time he goes for a job, afterwards, one of the first things employers do is Google his name, and they find this. And they find it on the BBC website, and they then don't call him for interview, or he doesn't get a chance to develop his career. And it's he was so exercised by this, I haven't seen him for a while, that he tried to sue the BBC for a libel. That's what Boodoo and the BBC is about. And he tried to force it into a kind of a libelous mode. But actually, it wasn't really the central feature of that case. What he was trying to do was establish, and this takes me on to the second of my students, establish a kind of idea about a right to be forgotten. And I think we need to think a little bit about that in these few minutes that I've got with you, seriously think about, is whether or not we should reconfigure our human rights ideas to include this right to be able to be let alone, and not dogged by a past which may or may not be true, in Sam's case, not true, but it could equally be true, which past is so instantly available to us via the web. And this takes me to my second of my three students, Paul Bernal. Paul is doing a fascinating PhD at LSE, and he's written an article in European Journal of Law and Technology, 2011, just out. And the article is called A Right to Delete. And interestingly, the European Directive, new thinking on this, new drafts, are thinking about this notion of a right to be forgotten. And Paul is arguing, as he does in his thesis, that we need to have a kind of paradigm shift in the field of technology away from the right to presumptively know to a right to privacy with the possibility of knowledge. And it works right away across everything, into Google and into how much data you communicate when you get onto a website and so on, but includes this notion of not, says Paul, the right to be forgotten, but a right to delete. Should we be able to order a website to remove stuff which is untrue, disproportionately damaging, a kind of equivalent of a rehabilitation of offenders provision? And then, and thirdly, there's my PhD student called Emily Laidlaw, who's brought to my attention the work of Victor Mayer Schoenberger, whom you may know of or know, and he's written a book called Delete, The Virtue of Forgetting in the Digital Age. That's a fascinating book, The Virtue of Forgetting. And what he says is, he says, Victor Mayer Schoenberger, he says, historically, and in cultural terms, and in terms of coping, forgetting is not a weakness, it is a strength. We need to forget. We must be able to lose stuff. And then, thinking about this, and thinking about the damage that Facebook can do to the career opportunities of people, thinking about a case in which I wasn't involved, but in which the Facebook of the claimant destroyed the claimant's submissions, and it having been easily accessible was the basis for the cross-examination, etc. Thinking about the way in which a senior tutor, whom I know very well, got into a little bit of trouble because he trawled through Facebook in order to see what the students were really like. Is there not some way in which we should be able to be empowered here in order to recover the strengths of forgetting, to be able to argue for the removal of stuff? What Victor Mayer Schoenberger argues for is a right to reputation bankruptcy. Interesting idea. Liam Fox, I think, would be first in the queue. But you see the point. You see the point. Things have got too far. I want to make a fresh start. You know, in the old days, you could make a fresh start. If anybody's read the biography of Rockefeller, it's amazing. Rockefeller's dad would just cheat everybody and then move on to the next place. And you know, okay, that's going a bit far. But there is no next place now. And maybe we need to celebrate forgetfulness. There's a... I guess before we go to Q&A, it might be my last point. There's a woman in California, I don't know if you know about her, Jill Price. Anybody know about her? Anybody know about her? Well, Jill Price is 41 years old, and from the age of 11, she has become aware of something. And what she's become aware of is that she never forgets anything at all. Ever. And if you want to look at her, have a look at an interview that she did with one of the American commentators, Sawyer, Diane Sawyer. She remembers what she had for breakfast on the 6th of July, 1975. She has played to her the theme music from a selection of soap television programs from, in one case, it ran only for three shows in 1971. And she remembers them all. She remembers every detail about everything. And she's a haunted woman, you know. It's an extreme example of the brain that, through this quirk of fate, has no capacity to manage the world. So, you know, there's one or two serious points there. There's a serious point about unknown unknowns. We need a democratic culture. There's a serious point, however, about not allowing the juggernaut of knowing to steamroll us into a position where we're incapable of thinking innovatively about not yesterday's challenges, but today's challenges. How to manage knowledge properly as advocates and as educators, and how to achieve the right balance between knowing and not knowing. And it's not just about privacy and freedom of expression, it's about also our capacity to continue to function, yes, with the past, but not with the past, which totally, totally makes the future impossible. So I think in the vein of Lord Leicester, I'll ask for some questions at that point. Would that be all right? Are we close enough to 5 o'clock? Or have we gone to 6 o'clock, 10 past 6? Already five past.
Yeah.
Sorry about
but
that.
But I'm sure people would want to ask some questions. So over to the floor, anybody?
Thank you very much, Connor.
Not at all. Maybe you had some questions and just forgotten what they were.
None of us are Jill Price. No.
How do we know? How do we know where are we going to draw the line? And what's the past we forget?
Yeah.
What's the past we need to carry forward?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think you need to discreetly decide which issue we're going to look at. I mean, I think broadly we've got the balance right on privacy and freedom of speech through litigation fed down through the legal system. On the right to delete, I think that's a very interesting one. About it's an analogy maybe with rehabilitation of offenders, you know, where we've actually got legislation where people want to put their criminal past behind them, and maybe we can borrow from that kind of precedent, which would suggest legislation in that area. So I think we need to pick out which area it is and then work through how best to address the issue from the point of view of the kind of principles I was setting out, I would say.
Would a right to delete just last throughout the lifetime of a person so that once they die we can remember all the bad things that they did?
That would make the reading of the will kind of fun, wouldn't it? A good one, I don't know. I mean, you know, in some traditions we always say don't speak ill of the dead, but of course the dead can't sue, so I'm sure Anthony's very familiar with one of the first pieces of legal advice, which is the person alive or dead? And Alistair Campbell told me quite a funny one about Mr. Dacre, or was it Sir David English, but having a good go at Alistair's dad over something or else, and Alistair ringing him up and saying, you know, my dad's alive, and Dacre saying, okay, how much do you need?
Connor, I see your point about especially young people who've put an awful lot of information out into the public domain, and suddenly years later the consequences can come to bear. But is there not a really important public debate about the importance of keeping a historical record, be that a cultural one as much as a political one? And we see the benefit now of access to somebody's diary X years ago and give us an insight into the political dimensions of the time, or diary is electronic, and it's made up of Facebook, where people used to keep written diaries before.
What might have begun to happen, I agree with you that there's been a period of time which has been one marked by the lack of these diaries and by all email exchange and so on, but it may be that with the blogs we've now got a return to a kind of prolific quality of the diary, so a lot of people are keeping blogs where they're commenting on news, and they may become archivally interesting. Clearly, if you were to have a right to delete, you'd need to work through the implications for the public record. Again, we have analogies that we can borrow from with Public Records Act, for example. There are ways in which this can be managed, where there might be a kind of period of relative freedom, or it could be linked to death, for example, and we don't lose the material, because electronically it might exist, but it's just not accessible in a way which has a disproportionate impact on the person's life.
Although now we're looking at an international dimension more than a national. We have laws here, rehabilitation of offenders, whereby here we have transposed that to an international state.
Yeah, which is why it's interesting and significant that the EU draft renewed directive is actually addressing this kind of issue, and EU is even merely regional, but it's a start.
One final question then from Lord Leicester.
Conor, you come from a constitutional background, which you need to disclose, in which the Irish constitution, unlike any other I know, has a very strong bias in favour of the right to reputation and private life, which has even led a majority of your Supreme Court to decide that parliamentary committees are not allowed to investigate any public interest matter which might trench on the personal reputation of anybody, and has further led them now to have a referendum to overdo that. Yeah. Don't you think in your attitude towards history and the deletion of history and privacy, you might be reflecting unconsciously your own constitutional background?
I wondered whether it was a question or a statement, and often with Lord Leicester it's hard to tell the difference between the two, but he is closer to the bone than he thinks, because this will startle you, Anthony, but actually I went to school across the road from the house in which that poor fellow was shot, which is what led to the inquiry, which is what produced the case, which is what produced the ruling, which has led to the referendum. Abbey Lara is the name of the town.
Exactly.
And that was where I'm from. So yeah. I'm very close to it. I think it's a serious point. That was a very serious point. This is a very serious point. This is a kind of paradigm shift where what you do, you start thinking about the difficulties in a change rather than assuming that the status quo is what you constantly discuss. So it's a kind of effort to think in a kind of different kind of way. Of course, these are critically important points. But maybe by approaching them in this kind of different way, we suddenly see solutions which previously it hadn't occurred to us were relevant because we hadn't seen the problem. So it's a kind of way of shifting our mentality.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much, Conor.
Thank you.
Lord Leicester and...
ending, I hope, to what I also hope was a very stimulating day.